Hello, hello, welcome back to another section of Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. Hope you are doing well. Sorry, it's been a while. Here, let me fix this. All right. And yeah, I've just been real busy, so have not had the chance to read much, but I really want to get into this again. It's going to take us many, many seconds to finish this, I think. What is this, part 9 or something like that? And we're only about a third of the way through, so my hope is that we can finish it by the end of the year, which is really going to mean that I have to get going on this one. So, if you are liking it though, hit the like button. That will encourage me to keep them coming quickly. And subscribe so that you can get the rest of the book and go back and watch the beginning of it if you're just joining us. So, we are on page 146. We are in 1926 now. This chapter is titled Adieu. It is a fact of human life that one must eventually choose a philosophy, or such was the opinion of the Count as he stood before his old windows in suite 317, having slipped inside with the help of Nina's key. Whether through careful consideration spawned by books and spirited debate over coffee at 2 a.m, or simply from a natural proclivity, we must all eventually adopt a fundamental framework, some reasonably coherent system of causes and effects that will help us make sense not simply of momentous events, but all the little actions and interactions that constitute our daily lives, be they deliberate or spontaneous, inevitable or unforeseen. For most Russians, the philosophical consolations had been found for centuries under the eaves of the church, whether they favored the unflinching hand of the Old Testament or the more forgiving hand of the New. Their submission to the will of God helped them to understand or at least accept the inescapable course of events. In keeping with the fashion of the times, most of the Count's schoolmates had turned their backs on the church, but they had only done so in favor of alternative consolations. Some who preferred the clarity of science adhered to the ideas of Darwin, seeing at every turn the mark of natural selection, while others opted for Nietzsche and his eternal recurrence, or Hegel and his dialectic. Each system quite sensible, no doubt, when one had finally arrived at the 1,000th page. But for the Count, his philosophical leanings had always been essentially meteorological. Specifically, he believed in the inevitable influence of clement and inclement weathers. He believed in the influence of early frosts and lingering summers, of ominous clouds and delicate rains, of fog and sunshine and snowfall. And he believed most especially in the reshaping of destinies by the slightest change in the thermometer. By way of example, one need only look down from his window, not 3 weeks before, with the temperature hovering around 45 degrees Fahrenheit. Theater Square had been empty and gray. But with an increase in the average temperature of just 5 degrees, the trees had begun to blossom, the sparrows had begun to sing, and couples young and old were lingering on the benches. If such a slight change in temperature was all it took to transform the life of a public square, why should we think the course of human history any less susceptible? Napoleon would have been the first to admit that after assembling the intrepid corps of commanders and 15 divisions, after assessing the enemy's weaknesses, studying his terrain, and carefully formulating a plan of attack, one must finally contend with temperature. For the reading on the thermometer will not only govern the pace of advance, but will also determine the adequacy of supplies, and either bolster or betray the courage of one's men. Ah, Napoleon, perhaps you would never have prevailed in your quest for Mother Russia, but 10 degrees warmer, and at least you might have reached home with half your forces intact, instead of losing another 300,000 men between the gates of Moscow and the banks of the Niemen River. But if examples from the field of battle are not to your taste, then consider instead a party in late autumn, to which you and a loose-knit band of friends and acquaintances have been invited to celebrate the 21st birthday of the charming Princess Novobatsky. At 5 o'clock, when you look from your dressing room window, the weather seems certain to weigh upon the festivities, for with the temperature at 34 degrees, clouds as far as the eye can see, and the onset of a drizzling rain, the princess's guests will be arriving at her party cold, wet, and a little worse for wear. But by the time you set out at 6, the temperature has dropped just enough that what begins to land on your shoulders is not a gray autumnal rain, but the season's first snowfall. Thus, the very precipitation that might have soured the evening instead lends it an aura of magic. In fact, so mesmerizing is the manner in which the snowflakes spiral through the air that you are run from the road when a troika passes at full gallop, with a young officer of the hussars standing at the reins like a centurion in his chariot. Having spent about an hour freeing your carriage from a ditch, you arrive at the princess's late, but as luck would have it, so does a portly old friend from your days at the academy. In fact, you get to watch as he alights from his droshky, throws back his shoulders, fills out his chest, and then tests the formality of the footman by slipping on a patch of ice and landing on his rump. Helping him up, you hook your arm under his and lead him into the house just as the rest of the party is spilling from the drawing room. In the dining room, you make a quick circle of the table in search of your name, assuming that, given your reputation as a regateur, you will once again be placed beside some awkward cousin. But, lo and behold, you have been seated at the right hand of the guest of honor, while on the princess's left is none other than the dashing young hussar who had run you from the road. With a glance, you can see that he fancies himself the natural recipient of the princess's attention. Clearly, he expects to regale her with tales of the regiment while occasionally refilling her glass with wine. When the meal is over, he will offer his arm and lead her into the ballroom where he will display his talents at the mazurka. And when the orchestra plays Strauss, he will not need to waltz the princess across the floor because he will be on the terrace in her arms. But just as the young lieutenant, is about to tell his first anecdote, doors to the kitchen open and three footmen appear bearing platters. All eyes turn to see what Mrs. Trent has prepared for the occasion, and when the three silver domes are lifted simultaneously, there are gasps of appreciation. For in honor of the princess, she has cooked her specialty, English roast with Yorkshire pudding. In the history of man, no military commissary has raised envy. Due to a combination of efficiency, disinterest, and a lack of a feminine touch, all the food in an army kitchen is boiled until the tops rattle off the pots. So, having made do with cabbage and potatoes for 3 months straight, the young lieutenant is unprepared for the arrival of Mrs. Trent's beef. Seared for 15 minutes at 350 degrees, then roasted for 2 hours at 350, her roast is tender and red at the center, yet crispy and brown at the crust. Thus, our young hussar sets aside his regimental tales in favor of extra helpings and the refilling of his own glass with wine, while in accordance with the established rules of etiquette, it is you who must entertain the princess with a few amusing stories of your own. Having cleaned the gravy from his plate with the last crust of the pudding, the young lieutenant finally turns his attention to his hostess. But at that very same moment, the orchestra begins tuning in the ballroom and the guests push back their chairs. So he simply holds out his arm for the princess as your portly friend appears at your side. Now there is nothing your friend loves better than a good quadrille, and despite his physique, he has been known to hop like a rabbit and prance like a buck. But placing his hand on his tailbone, he explains that his spill on the drive has left him too sore to gallivant. He wonders instead if you would like to play a few hands of cards, and you respond it would be your pleasure. But it just so happens that the lieutenant overhears this exchange and, in a boisterous frame of mind, imagines here's a perfect opportunity to teach some dandies a thing or two about games of chance. Besides, he reasons to himself the orchestra will be playing for hours and the princess is going nowhere. So without further thought, he passes her arm to the nearest gentleman and invites himself to join you at the card table while signaling the butler for another glass of wine. Well, perhaps it was that extra glass of wine. Perhaps it was the lieutenant's tendency to underestimate a well-dressed man. Or perhaps it was simply bad luck. Whatever the cause, suffice it to say that after 2 hours, it is the lieutenant who has lost 1,000 rubles, and you who holds his marker. But however recklessly the fellow drives his troika, you have no wish to put him in his spot. It is the princess's birthday, you say. In her honor, let us call it even. And with that, you tear the lieutenant's marker in two and toss the halves on the bays. In appreciation, he sweeps his wine glass to the floor, knocks back his chair, and stumbles out the terrace doors into the night. Although in the course of the game there were only 5 players and 3 observers, the story of the torn IOU quickly makes its way around the ballroom, and suddenly the princess has sought you out in order to express her gratitude for this act of gallantry. As you bow and reply, "It is nothing," the band strikes up a waltz, and you have no choice but to take her in your arms and spirit her across the floor. The princess waltzes divinely. She is light on her feet and spins like a top. But with more than 40 couples dancing and the fires in the 2 fireplaces built unusually high, the ambient temperature in the ballroom reaches 80 degrees, prompting the princess's cheeks to flush and her bosom to heave. Concerned that she may be feeling faint, naturally you inquire if she would like some air. You see, if Mrs. Trent had not so perfectly mastered the art of roasting, the young lieutenant might have kept his attention on the princess instead of washing down a 3rd helping of beef with an 8th glass of wine. If the temperature that night had not dropped 6 degrees in as many hours, the ice might not have formed in the drive, your portly friend might not have fallen, and the card game might not have been played. And if the sight of snow hadn't prompted the footmen to build the fire so high, you might not have ended up on the terrace in the arms of the birthday girl, as the young hussar returned his supper to the pasture from whence it came. And what is more, thought the count with a grave expression, all the sorry events that followed might never have come to pass. What is this? Who are you? Turning from the window, the count discovered a middle-aged couple standing in the doorway with the key to the suite in their hands. What are you doing here? The husband demanded.
I am from the draper's,
the count replied. Turning back to the window, he took hold of the curtain and gave it a tug.
Yes, he said. Everything seems in order.
Then he doffed the cap he wasn't wearing and escaped into the hall.
Good evening, Vasily.
Ah, good evening, Count Rostov.
The count gave the desk a delicate tap.
Have you seen Nina about?
She is in the ballroom, I believe.
Ah, just so.
The count was pleasantly surprised to hear that Nina was back in one of her old haunts. Now 13, Nina had all but given up her youthful pastimes in favor of books and professors. To have set aside her studies, there must have been quite an assembly assembled. But when the count opened the door, there was no shuffling of chairs or pounding of podiums. Nina was sitting alone at a small table under the central chandelier. The count noted that her hair was tucked behind her ears, an unfailing indication that something of significance was in the works. Sure enough, on the pad before her was a 6x3 grid, while on the table sat a set of scales, a measuring tape, and a sprinter's watch.
Greetings, my friend.
Oh, hello, your countship.
What, pray tell, are you up to?
We are preparing for an experiment.
The count looked around the ballroom.
We?
Nina pointed with her pencil to the balcony. Looking up, the count discovered a boy Nina's age, crouching in their old perch behind the balustrade. Simply, though neatly dressed, the boy had wide eyes and an expression that was earnest and attentive. Along the balustrade were lined a series of objects of different shapes and sizes. Nina made the introductions.
Count Rostov, Boris.
Boris, Count Rostov.
Good afternoon, Boris.
Good afternoon, sir.
The count turned back to Nina. What is the nature of this endeavor?
We intend to test the hypotheses of 2 renowned mathematicians in a single experiment. Specifically, we will be testing Newton's calculation of the speed of gravity and Galileo's principle that objects with different masses fall at an equivalent rate. From the balustrade, wide-eyed Boris nodded earnestly and attentively. By way of illustration, Nina pointed her pencil to the first column of her grid, in which 6 objects were listed in ascending order of size.
Where did you get the pineapple?
From the fruit bowl in the lobby, Boris called down with enthusiasm. Nina set down her pencil. Let's start with the kopeck, Boris. Remember to hold it precisely at the top of the balustrade and drop it exactly when I tell you to do so. For a moment, the count wondered if the height of the balcony was sufficient to measure the influence of mass on the descent of varying objects. After all, hadn't Galileo climbed the Tower of Pisa when he executed his experiment?
and surely the balcony wasn't high enough to calculate the acceleration of gravity. But it is hardly the role of casual observer to call into question the methodology of the seasoned scientist. So the Count kept his wonderings where they belonged. Boris took up the kopeck, and showing due consideration for the seriousness of the task, he carefully arranged himself so that he could hold the designated object precisely at the top of the balustrade. After making a notation on her pad, Nina picked up her watch. On the count of three, Boris. One, two, three. Boris released the coin, and after a moment of silence, it pinged against the floor. Nina looked at her watch. 1.25 seconds, she called to Boris. Check, he replied, carefully noting the datum in its corresponding square on a separate sheet of paper. Nina divided the figure by a factor, carried its remainder, subtracted the difference, and so on and so forth, until she rounded the solution to the second decimal. Then she shook her head in apparent disappointment. 32 feet per second per second. Boris responded with an expression of scientific concern. The egg, Nina said. The egg, which presumably had been liberated from the piazza's kitchen, was held precisely, released exactly, and timed to the centisecond. The experiment continued with a teacup, a billiard ball, a dictionary, and the pineapple, all of which completed their journey to the dance floor in the same amount of time. Thus, in the ballroom of the Metropole Hotel on the 21st of June 1926, was the heretic Galileo of Galilei, vindicated by a ping, a splat, a smash, a thunk, a thump, and a thud. Of the six objects, the teacup was the Count's personal favorite. It not only made a satisfying smash upon impact, but the immediate aftermath, one could hear the shards of porcelain skidding across the floor like acorns across the ice. Having completed her tally, Nina observed a little sadly. Professor Lisitsky said that these hypotheses have been tested over time. Yes, said the Count, I imagine they have. Then to lighten her spirits, he suggested that it was almost 8 o'clock. Perhaps she and her young friend might join him for supper at the Boyarsky. Alas, she and Boris had another experiment to perform, one that involved a bucket of water, a bicycle, and the perimeter of Red Square. On this of all nights, was the Count disappointed that Nina and her young friend couldn't join him for supper? Of course he was. And yet, the Count had always been of the opinion that God, who could easily have split the hours of darkness and light right down the middle, had chosen instead to make the days of summer longer for scientific expeditions of just this very sort. In addition, the Count had a pleasant inkling that Boris might prove to be the first in a long line of earnest and attentive young men who would be dropping eggs from balustrades and riding bikes with buckets. Then I leave it to you, said the Count with a smile. All right, but had you come for something in particular? No, the Count replied after a pause. Nothing in particular. But as he turned toward the door, something did occur to him. Nina. She looked up from her work. Even though these hypotheses have been tested over time, I think you are perfectly right to test them again. Nina studied the Count for a moment. Yes, she said with a nod. You have always known me the best. At 10 o'clock, the Count was seated in the Boyarsky with an empty plate and a nearly empty bottle of white on the table. With the day drawing rapidly to a close, he took some pride in knowing that everything was in order. That morning, having received a visit from Konstantin Konstantinovich, the Count had brought his accounts up to date at Muir and Mirelli's, now known as the Central Universal Department Store, Filipov's, the first Moscow bakery, and of course the Metropole. At the Grand Duke's desk, he had written a letter to Mishka, which he had then entrusted to Petya, with instructions it be mailed on the following day. In the afternoon, he had paid his weekly visit to the barber and tidied up his rooms. He had donned his burgundy smoking jacket, which, to be perfectly frank, was disconcertingly snug, and in its pocket he placed a single gold coin for the undertaker with instructions that he be dressed in the freshly pressed black suit, which had been laid out on his bed, and that his body be buried in the family plot at Eilhauer. But if the Count took pride in knowing that everything was in order, He took comfort in knowing that the world would carry on without him. In fact, it already had. The night before, he had happened to be standing at the concierge's desk when Vasily produced a map of Moscow for one of the hostel's guests. As Vasily drew a zigzagging line from the center of the city to the garden ring, more than half the streets he named were unfamiliar to the Count. Earlier that day, Vasily had informed him that the famed blue and gold lobby of the Bolshoi had been painted over in white, while in the Arbat, Andreev's moody statue of the Gogol had been plucked from its pedestal and replaced with a more uplifting one of Gorky. Just like that, the city of Moscow could boast new street names, new lobbies, and new statues, and neither the tourists, the theatergoers, nor the pigeons seemed particularly put out. The staffing trend that had begun with the appointment of the bishop had continued unabated, such that any young man with more influence than experience could now don the white jacket, clear from the left, and pour wine into water glasses. Marina, who had once welcomed the Count's company as she stitched in the sitting room, now had a junior seamstress to watch over as well as a toddler at home. God bless. Nina, who had taken her first steps into the modern world and found it just as worthy of her unblinking intelligence as the study of princesses, was moving with her father to a large apartment in one of the new buildings designated for the use of party officials. And it was the third week of June. The fourth annual Congress of RAPP was underway, but Mishka was not in attendance, having taken a leave from his post at the university in order to finish his short story anthology, now in 5 volumes, and to follow Katerina back to Kiev, where she was teaching in an elementary school. On occasion, the Count shared a cup of coffee on the roof with the handyman, Abram, where they would talk of summer nights in Nizhny Novgorod. But the old man was now so nearsighted and uncertain on his feet that one morning earlier that month, as if in anticipation of his retirement, the bees had disappeared from their hives. So yes, life was rolling along, just as it always had. Looking back, the Count recalled how on the first night of his house arrest, in the spirit of his godfather's old maxim, he had committed himself to mastering his circumstances. Well, in retrospect, there was another story his godfather told that was just as worthy of emulation. It entailed the Grand Duke's close friend, Admiral Stepan Makarov, who commanded the Imperial Russian Navy during the Russo-Japanese War. On the 13th of April 1904, with Port Arthur under attack, Makarov led his battleships into the fray and drove the Japanese fleet back into the Yellow Sea. But upon returning to port on calm seas, the flagship struck a Japanese mine and began to take on water. So, with the battle won and the shores of his homeland in sight, Makarov ascended to the helm in full military dress and went down with his ship. The Count's bottle of white, which he was fairly certain was a Chardonnay from Burgundy and best served at 55 degrees, sat sweating on the table. Reaching across his plate, he picked up the bottle and served himself. Then, having made a toast of gratitude to the Boyarsky, the Count emptied his glass and headed to the Shilopin for one last snifter of brandy. When the Count arrived at the Shilopin, his plan had been to enjoy the brandy, pay Audrius his respects, then retire to his study to await the chime of 12. But as he neared the bottom of his glass, he couldn't help but overhear a conversation taking place farther down the bar between a high-spirited young Brit and a German traveler for whom travel had obviously lost all its charms. What had first drawn the Count's attention was the Brit's enthusiasm for Russia. In particular, the young man was taken with the whimsical architecture of the churches and the rambunctious tenor of the language. But with a dour expression, the German replied that the only contribution the Russians have made to the West was the invention of vodka. Then, presumably to drive home his point, he emptied his glass. "Come now," said the Brit, "you can't be serious." The German gave his younger neighbor the look of one who had no experience being anything but serious.
I will buy a glass of vodka, he said, for any man in this bar who can name three more. Now, vodka was not the Count's preferred spirit. In point of fact, despite his love for his country, he rarely drank it. What's more, he had already polished off a bottle of white and a snifter of brandy, and he still had his own rather pressing business to attend to. But when a man's country is dismissed so offhandedly, he cannot hide behind his preferences or his appointments, especially when he has drunk a bottle of white and a snifter of brandy. So, having sketched a quick instruction for Audrius on the back of a napkin and tucked it under a 1-ruble note, the Count cleared his throat. Excuse me, gentlemen, I couldn't help but overhear your exchange. I have no doubt, mein Herr, that your remark regarding Russia's contributions to the West was a form of inverted hyperbole, an exaggerated diminution of the facts for poetic effect. Nonetheless, I will take you at your word and happily accept your challenge. I'll be damned, said the Brit. But I do have one condition, added the Count. And what is that? Asked the German. That for each of the contributions I name, we shall drink a glass of vodka together. The German, who was scowling, waved a hand in the air as if he were about to dismiss the Count, much as he had dismissed the country. But ever attentive, Audrius had already set 3 empty glasses on the bar and was filling them to the brim. Thank you, Audrius. My pleasure, Your Excellency. Number 1, said the Count, adding a pause for dramatic effect. Chekhov and Tolstoy. The German let out a grunt. Yes, yes, I know what you're going to say, that every nation has its poets in the pantheon. But with Chekhov and Tolstoy, we Russians have set the bronze bookends on the mantelpiece of narrative. Henceforth, writers of fictions from wheresoever they hail will place themselves on the continuum that begins with one and ends with the other. For who, I asked you, has exhibited better mastery of the shorter form than Chekhov in his flawless little stories? Precise and uncluttered, they invite us into some corner of a household at some discreet hour in which the entire human condition is suddenly within reach, if heartbreakingly so. While at the other extreme, can you conceive of a work greater in scope than War and Peace, one that moves so deftly from the parlor to the battlefield and back again, that so fully investigates how the individual is shaped by history and history by the individual? In the generations to come, I tell you, there will be no new authors to supplant these two as the alpha and omega of narrative. I dare say he has something there, said the Brit. Then he raised his glass and emptied it. So the Count empties his, and after a grumble, the German followed suit. Number 2, asked the Brit, as Audrius refilled the glasses. Act 1, scene 1 of The Nutcracker. Tchaikovsky, the German guffawed. You laugh, mein Herr, and yet I would wager 1,000 crowns that you can picture it yourself. On Christmas Eve, having celebrated with family and friends in a room dressed with garlands, Clara sleeps soundly on the floor with her new magnificent toy. But at the stroke of midnight, with the one-eyed Drosselmeyer perched on the grandfather clock like an owl, the Christmas tree begins to grow. As the Count raised his hand slowly over the bar to suggest the growth of the tree, the Brit began to whistle the famous march from the opening act. Yes, exactly, said the Count to the Brit. It is commonly said that the English know how to celebrate Advent best. But with all due respect, to witness the essence of winter cheer, one must venture farther north than London. One must venture above the 50th parallel to where the course of the sun is its most elliptical, and force of the wind its most unforgiving. Dark, cold, and snowbound, Russia has the sort of climate in which the spirit of Christmas burns brightest. And that is why Tchaikovsky seems to have captured the sound of it better than anyone else. I tell you that not only will every European child of the 20th century know the melodies of the Nutcracker, they will imagine their Christmas just as it is depicted in the ballet. And on the Christmas eves of their dotage, Tchaikovsky's tree will grow from the floor of their memories until they are gazing up in wonder once again. The Brit gave a sentimental laugh and emptied his glass. The story was written by a Prussian, said the German, as he begrudgingly lifted his drink.
I grant you that, conceded the Count. And but for Tchaikovsky, it would have remained in Prussia. As Audrius refilled the glasses, the ever-attentive tender at bar noted the Count's look of inquiry and replied with a nod of confirmation. Third, said the Count. Then in lieu of explanation, he simply gestured to the Shilopin's entrance, where a waiter suddenly appeared with a silver platter balanced on the palm of his hand, placing the platter on the bar between the two foreigners. He lifted the dome to reveal a generous serving of caviar, accompanied by blini and sour cream. Even the German could not help but smile, his appetite getting the better of his prejudices. Anyone who has spent an hour drinking vodka by the glass knows that the size has surprisingly little to do with a man's capacity. There are tiny men for whom the limit is 7 and giants for whom it is 2. For our German friend, the limit appeared to be 3. For if the Tolstoy dropped him in a barrel and the Tchaikovsky sent him adrift, then the caviar sent him over the falls. So, having wagged a chastising finger at the Count, he moved to the corner of the bar, laid his head on his arms, and dreamed of the sugar plum fairy. Taking this as a signal, the Count prepared to push back his stool, but the young Brit was refilling his glass. The caviar was a stroke of genius, he said. But how did you manage it? You never left our sight. A magician never reveals his secrets. The Brit laughed. Then he studied the Count as if with renewed curiosity. Who are you? The Count shrugged. I'm someone you have met in a bar. No, that's not quite it. I know a man of erudition when I meet one. And I heard how the bartender referred to you. Who are you really? The Count offered a self-deprecating smile. At one time, I was Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov, recipient of the Order of St. Andrew, member of the Jockey Club, master of the hunt. The young Brit held out his hand. Charles Abernethy. Presumptive heir to the Earl of Westmoreland, financier's apprentice, and bowman of the Losting Cambridge crew at Henley in 1920. The two gentlemen shook hands and drank, and then the presumptive heir to the Earl of Westmoreland studied the Count again. This must have been quite a decade for you. You could put it that way, said the Count. Did you try to leave after the revolution? On the contrary, Charles, I came back because of it. Charles looked at the Count in surprise. You came back? I was in Paris when the Hermitage fell. I had left the country before the war due to certain circumstances. You were an anarchist, were you? The Count laughed. Hardly. Then what? The Count looked into his empty glass. He hadn't spoken of these events in so many years. It is late, he said, and the story is long. By way of response, Charles refilled their glasses. So the Count took Charles all the way back to the fall of 1913, when on an inclement night he had set out for the 21st birthday of the Princess Novobusky. He described the ice on the driveway and Mrs. Trent's roast and the torn IOU and how a few degrees here and there had landed him on the terrace in the arms of the princess while the rash lieutenant retched in the grass. Charles laughed. But Alexander, that sounds splendid. Surely it's not the reason you left Russia. No, admitted the Count, but then he continued with his fateful tale. 7 months pass, Charles. It is spring of 1914, and I return to the family estate for a visit. Having paid my respects to my grandmother in the library, I venture outside in search of my sister Helena, who likes to read under the great elm in the bend at the bend in the river. From 100 feet away, I can tell she is not herself. That is, I can tell she is more than herself. Upon seeing me, she sits up with a sparkle in her eyes and a smile on her lips, clearly eager to share some piece of news which I am now equally eager to hear. But just as I cross the lawn toward her, she looks over my shoulder and smiles even more brightly to see a lone figure approaching on a steed, a lone figure in the uniform of the hussars. You see, the dilemma the fox had put me in, Charles. While I had been caressing back in Moscow, he had sought my sister out. He had arranged an introduction and then courted her carefully, patiently, successfully. And when he swung down from the saddle and our eyes met, he could barely keep the twist of mirth from his lips. But how was I to explain the situation to Helena? this angel of 1,000 virtues. How was I to tell her that the man she had fallen in love with has sought her affections not due to an appreciation of her qualities, but to settle a score?
What did you do?
Ah, Charles, what did I do? I did nothing. I thought surely his true nature would find occasion to express itself, much as it had at the Novoboskys. So in the weeks that followed, I hovered at the edge of their courtship. I suffered through lunches and teas. I ground my teeth as I watched them stroll through the gardens. But as I bided my time, his self-control surpassed my wildest expectations. He pulled out her chair, he picked blossoms, he read verses, he wrote verses. And always when he caught my eye, there was that little twist in his smile. But then on the afternoon of my sister's 20th birthday, when he was off on maneuvers and we were paying a visit to a neighbor, we returned at dusk to find his troika in front of our house. From a glance at Helena, I could sense her elation. He has rushed back all the way from his battalion, she was thinking, to wish me well on my day. She nearly jumped from her horse and ran up the steps, and I followed her like a condemned man to the noose. The Count emptied his glass and slowly set it back onto the bar. But there inside the entry hall, I did not find my sister in his arms. I found her 2 steps from the door, trembling. Against the wall was Nadezhda, my sister's handmaiden, her bodice torn open, her arms across her chest, her face scarlet with humiliation. She looked briefly at my sister, then ran up the stairs. In horror, my sister stumbled across the hall, collapsed in a chair, and covered her face with her hands. And our noble lieutenant, he grinned at me like a cat. When I began to express my outrage, he said, "Oh, come now, Alexander, it is Helena's birthday. In her honor, let us call it even." Then, roaring with laughter, he walked out the door without giving my sister a glance. Charles whistled softly. The Count nodded. But at this juncture, Charles, I did not do nothing. I crossed the entryway to the wall where a pair of pistols hung beneath the family crest. When my sister grabbed at my sleeve and asked where I was going, I too walked out the door without giving her a glance. The Count shook his head in condemnation of his own behavior. He had a 1-minute head start, but he hadn't used it to put distance between us. He had casually climbed into his troika and set his horses moving at a little more than a trot. And there you have him in a nutshell. My friend, a man who raced toward parties and trotted from his own misdeeds. Charles refilled their glasses and waited. Our drive was a grand circle that connected the house to the main road by 2 opposing arcs lined with apple trees. My horse was still tied at its post, so when I saw him riding away, I mounted and set off in the opposite direction at a gallop. In a matter of minutes, I had reached the point where the 2 arcs of the drive met the road. Dismounting, I stood and waited for his approach. You can picture the scene. Me alone in the drive, with the sky blue, the breeze blowing, and the apple trees in bloom. Though he had left the house at a little more than a trot, when he saw me, he rose to his feet, raised his whip, and began driving his horses at full speed. There was no question as to what he intended to do, so without a second thought, I raised my arm, steadied my aim, and pulled the trigger. The impact of the bullet knocked him off his feet. The reins flew free, and the horses careened off the drive, rolling the troika and tossing him into the dust where he lay unmoving.
You killed him?
Yes, Charles, I killed him. The presumptive heir to the Earl of Westmoreland slowly nodded his head. Right there in the dust. The Count sighed and took a drink. No, it was 8 months later. Charles looked confused.
8 months later?
Yes, in February 1915. You see, ever since my youth, I had been known for my marksmanship, and I had every intention of shooting the brute in the heart. But the road was uneven, and he was whipping his reins, and the apple blossoms were blowing in the wind. In a word, I missed my mark. I ended up shooting him here. The Count touched his right shoulder.
So then you didn't kill him?
Not at that moment. After binding his wound and riding his troika, I drove him home. Along the way, he cursed me at every turn of the wheel, and deservedly so, for while he survived the gunshot wound with his right arm now lame, he was forced to surrender his commission in the Hussars, and when his father filed an official complaint, my grandmother sent me to Paris, as was the custom at the time. But later that summer, when the war broke out, despite his injury, he insisted upon resuming his place at the head of his regiment. And in the second battle of the Masurian Lakes, he was knocked from his horse and run through with a bayonet by an Austrian dragoon. There was a moment of silence. Alexander, I am sorry that this fellow died in battle, but I think I can safely say that you have assumed more than your share of guilt for these events. But there was one more event to relate. 10 years ago tomorrow, while I was biding my time in Paris, my sister died. Of a broken heart? Young women only die of broken hearts in novels, Charles. She died of scarlet fever. The presumptive Earl shook his head in bewilderment. But don't you see, explained the Count, it is a chain of events. That night at the Novobuskys, when I magnanimously tore his marker, I knew perfectly well that word of the act would reach the princess, and I took the greatest satisfaction in turning the tables on the cad. But if I had not so smugly put him in his place, he would not have pursued Helena. He would have not humiliated her. I would not have shot him. He might not have died in Masuria. And 10 years ago, I would have been where I belonged, at my sister's side, when she finally breathed her last. Having capped off his snifter of brandy with 6 glasses of vodka, when the Count emerged from the attic hatch shortly before midnight, he weaved across the hotel's roof. With the wind a little wild and the building shifting back and forth, one could almost imagine one was crossing the deck of a ship on high seas. How fitting, thought the Count, as he paused to steady himself at the chimney stack. Then, picking his way among the irregular shadows that jutted here and there, he approached the building's northwest corner. For one last time, the Count looked out upon that city that was and wasn't his. Given the frequency of street lamps on major roads, he could easily identify the boulevard and garden rings, those concentric circles at the center of which was the Kremlin and beyond which was all of Russia. As long as there have been men on earth, reflected the Count, there have been men in exile. From primitive tribes to the most advanced societies, someone has occasionally been told by his fellow men to pack his bags, cross the border, and never set foot on his native soil again. But perhaps this was to be expected. After all, exile was the punishment that God meted out to Adam in the very first chapter of the human comedy, and that he meted out to Cain a few pages later. Yes, exile was as old as mankind. But the Russians were the first people to master the notion of sending a man into exile at home. As early as the 18th century, the Tsars stopped kicking their enemies out of the country, opting instead to send them to Siberia. Why? Because they had determined that to exile a man from Russia, as God had exiled Adam from Eden, was insufficient as a punishment, for in another country a man might immerse himself in his labors, build a house, raise a family. That is, he might begin his life anew. But when you exile a man into his own country, there is no beginning anew. For the exile at home, whether he be sent to Siberia or subject to the -6, the love for his country will not become vague or shrouded by the mists of time. In fact, because we have evolved as species to pay the utmost attention to that which is just beyond our reach, these men are likely to dwell on the splendors of Moscow more than any Muscovite who is at liberty to enjoy them. But enough of all that. Having retrieved a Bordeaux glass from the ambassador, the Count set it on a chimney top. He wrested the cork from the labelless bottle of Chateauneuf-du-Pape that he had taken from the Metropole's cellar back in 1924. Even as he poured the wine, he could tell it was an excellent vintage. Perhaps a 1900 or 1921. With his glass filled, he raised it in the direction of Eidelhauer. To Helena Rostov, he said, the flower of Nizhny Novgorod, lover of Pushkin, defender of Alexander, embroiderer of every pillowcase within reach, a little too brief, a heart too kind. Then he drank to the bottom of the glass. Though the bottle was far from empty, the Count did not refill the glass, nor did he toss it over his shoulder. Rather, he placed it with care on the chimney top, then approached the parapet where he stood to his full height. Before him sprawled the city, glorious and grandiose. Its legions of lights shimmered and reeled until they mixed with the movements of the stars. In one dizzy sphere, they spun, confusing the works of man with the works of heaven. Placing his right foot on the parapet's edge, Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov said, "Goodbye, my country." As if in reply, the beacon on Mishka's tower blinked. It was now the simplest of matters, like one who stands on a dock in spring preparing to take the first plunge of the season. All that remained was a leap, starting just six stories off the ground and falling at the speed of a kopeck, a teacup, or a pineapple. The entire journey would only take a matter of seconds, and then the circle would be complete. For a sunrise leads to sunset and dust to dust. As every river returns to the sea, just so a man must return to the embrace of oblivion from whence, "Your Excellency!" Turning in dismay at the interruption, the Count discovered Abram standing behind him in a state of excitement. In fact, Abram was in such a state of excitement that he showed not the slightest surprise at finding the Count poised on a spot where the roof met the ether. "I thought I heard your voice," said the old handyman. "I'm so glad you're here. You must come with me at once." "Abram, my friend," the Count began to explain, but the old man continued unabated. "You will not believe it if I tell you. You will have to see it for yourself." Then, without waiting for a response, he hurried with surprising agility toward his encampment. Count let out a sigh, assuring the city that he would be back in a moment. He followed Abram across the roof to the brazier, where the old man stopped and pointed to the northeast corner of the hotel. And there, against the brightly lit backdrop of the Bolshoi, one could just make out a frenzy of tiny shadows darting through the air. "They've returned," Abram exclaimed. "The bees?" "Yes. But that is not all. Sit. Abram gestured toward the plank of wood that had so often served as the Count's chair. As the Count stood the plank on end, Abram bent over his makeshift table. On it was a tray from one of the hives. He cut into the comb with a knife, spread the honey on a spoon, and handed it to the Count. Then he stood back with a smile of anticipation. "Well," he prompted, "go ahead." Dutifully, the Count put the spoon in his mouth. In an instant, there was the familiar sweetness of fresh honey, sunlit, golden, and gay. Given the time of year, the Count was expecting the first impression to be followed by a hint of lilacs from the Alexander Gardens or cherry blossoms from the garden ring. But as the elixir dissolved on his tongue, the Count became aware of something else entirely. Rather than the flowering trees of central Moscow, the honey had a hint of a grassy riverbank, a trace of a summer breeze, a suggestion of pergola. But most of all, there was the unmistakable essence of a thousand apple trees in bloom. Abram was nodding his head. "Nizhny Novgorod," he said, and it was, unmistakably so. "All these years, they must have been listening to us," Abram added in a whisper. The Count and the handyman both looked toward the roof's edge, where the bees, having traveled over 100 miles and applied themselves in willing industry, now wheeled above their hives as pinpoints of blackness, like the inverse of stars. It was nearly 2 a.m. when the Count bid Abram good night and returned to his bedroom. Taking the gold coin from his pocket, he placed it back on the stack inside the leg of his grandfather's desk, where it would remain untouched for another 28 years. And the following evening at 6, when the Boyarsky opened, the Count was the first one through its doors. "Andrei," he said to the maitre d', "can you spare a moment?" That is the end of that chapter, adieu, and is also the end of book 2. So next time we will begin with book 3. A new year on page 171 next time. So, yay! I'm glad that we finished that little section there. Hope you're enjoying this one, and see you next time.